I started with Confucius. Confucius is significant not only because he was the first person to develop a theory of politics, he was also the founder of a philosophical school, and technically speaking, that philosophical school exists to this very day. So we can say that he founded a philosophical lineage going back, or coming forward, up 2.5 millennia. And consequently, the Chinese call Confucius the first philosopher, if only because his particular school of philosophy has outlasted all the others. Confucius is called the first philosopher. The second, within the Confucian tradition, is a chap called Meng Tse, or Mencius. Mencius lived a couple generations after Confucius, very definitely late in the 4th century before the Common Era, and was pretty significant because, as Aristotle was to be to Plato, so Confucius was to Mencius. That is to say, the left to Confucius's right, the liberal to Confucius's conservative, the democrat to Confucius's aristocrat. All of this requires a little unpacking and explanation. So let me begin. Confucius's school, the school of the literati, is founded on a fundamental principle that the goal of politics should be the provision of an order that is attentive to tradition and specifically the traditional values of our given culture. Our given culture in this case, of course, being Chinese culture. But Confucianism as a system is transferable, as it was to Korea. So we have this broad system. Confucius himself was somewhat conservative. He was concerned to ensure that traditions were maintained. Mencius now takes a different tack. First of all, Mencius, unlike Confucius, has a positive view of human nature. That is to say, Mencius believes that human beings are, at bottom, positive and good. We become bad as a result of our being misled and misguided in our lives. Rather, we start out with the best of intentions, and only through our misunderstanding of our ends and our misunderstanding of what good things are and ought to be, do we fall away from the path. So, Mencius is someone who believes in human perfectibility. We can be made better. What we are, as we are normally, is fallen away from the good. So he has a positive view of humanity. And it is refreshing when you look at the ways in which political and ethical philosophers have viewed humanity for the past, 2.5 millennia. To encounter somebody who sees us as having positive value and who is for human beings as human beings is positively exhilarating. Of course, it's not a surprise that this should come in the tradition of Confucius, since Confucius is very clearly a humanist and concerned for human beings as human beings. This takes it one step further. Now, we know Mencius takes a number of positions very clearly because they are outlined in his book, simply known as the Mencius, the Book of Mencius. Some are very straightforward. A ruler's task is to attend to the needs of his people. That's a primary one. And Mencius puts it in one particularly interesting way. First, he says, comes the people. Then come the altars to the gods. Last comes the ruler. That is a very powerful principle that's articulated there. At other times, in other places, we tend to call that democracy. Mencius had no large-scale political experience of democracy, democracy not having been one of the alternatives that developed in China as a result of China not really having small city-states competing with each other and revolting all the time, as happened in Greece. Rather, Mencius establishes this as a first principle, that the source of a state's power is its people. That has consequences, because once you accept that power exercised by our rulers is exercised on behalf of us, then our rulers become our servants, and they are accountable to us, no matter how despotic they may seem. If they fail, they fail and must account to us. This gives us a rather different view of rule than might be expected from somebody who operates within a system in which tradition is important. Because tradition would seem to dictate that your ruler is a person who is there by tradition. But traditions cut in two ways. And one of them is that in China, the tradition had been established that every so often a dynasty would fall and be replaced by a new dynasty. And revolution and dynastic change are also tradition. The Shang were followed by the Xia, who are followed by the Zhou, who are currently in collapse, which is a condition that we find in 5th and 4th century BCE China. So what we have is a situation that by Mencius' time, we're calling the period of the Warring States. All that has happened is that each separate region of the old Zhou Kingdom has now declared itself an independent state, and each one of them wants to become China, wants to rule all of the old kingdom as empire. And that is what all the warfare is about. Mencius believes that warfare is wrong, that war is an evil and destructive act. He calls war earth eating the people, rather than the people eating of the earth. That's a particularly brutal and harsh way of seeing it, and I think it is one of the most honest and sharp and simple and decent ways of describing what war is. But Mencius takes us further. Because he is opposed to war, he is also going to be opposed to those who lead into war. And that matters, because one of the qualities of the ruler is justice, and one of the tasks of the ruler is the dispensing of justice. And how can you be just if you are unjust towards your people and lead them into war, lead them into destruction, lead them to be eaten by their own earth? You may be nothing then but a usurper, a false ruler. And thus he speaks of a king named Zhou and says, I do not know that a king was overthrown. I do know the man Zhou was overthrown. And this is dramatically important, tremendously important, because it enshrines in Mencius a principle. And it's a twofold principle. So let me unfold it one step at a time. In the first place, it situates power in the hands of the people. All power belongs to the people, since it was decisively an act of popular uprising that took Zhou off the throne and put another in his place. Secondly, we associate this particular principle with an Englishman named John Locke, who articulated it in 1689 of our common era, not with a Chinese gentleman named Mencius, who articulated it 1700 years earlier. We are looking at somebody in Mencius who has a fundamentally democratic vision of the state, has developed this vision from no practical knowledge of actual democracy. Unlike Plato and Aristotle, who had encountered the beast itself in its actual form in Greece, this is a man who has reasoned democracy from first principles. And this is a man who has presented democracy to us as the best form of choice of ruler. Not of government, because he hasn't said that democratic government is the best form. But he has said that when it comes to choosing the ruler, democracy is the best way, because our rulers are accountable to the people and to the gods, in order people first and gods second. And the people are to be able to judge the rulers. We thus have a conception of rulership as service. One that one comes across today when one encounters the term servant leadership, and one is convinced that the people using that term are actually serious about it, which is not always the case. And this is that principle, that to lead is to serve. To govern is a service and not a position of power and exaltation for its sake or for the ruler's sake alone. So Mencius, along with Aristotle, over there on the Mediterranean, can be considered one of the two founding theorists of democracy. Now, Mencius didn't get democracy, or at least the principle of democracy, out of nowhere. He got it in part from an agricultural practice of Chinese villages called the nine field system. This is a crosshatch mark in which fields are assigned in a village by using a hashtag or crosshatch mark, whatever you want to call it, and applying that to a patch of land so that each farmer gets one corner, one segment of the hashtag, except the one in the middle. The one in the middle is shared in common. And this was a way of partitioning land in the village that was egalitarian and democratic. So you have a principle of democratic operation in the villages, not in the ownership necessarily of the land, but in its management. So you see democracy there, just not in places of real power, but in a place where it did matter. And Mencius writes with approval of the nine-field system, this system in which each area of land is divided into nine segments, with one segment shared among the eight farmers who are allocated it. I find this to be of tremendous importance, not just because it comes early, but because it comes outside of where I was taught it comes from. I learnt the history of political thought from a Western perspective. As a result, I learnt that a large part of the development of political ideas came with the Western Enlightenment, that is, from the 16th century on, and really with the 17th century being the starting point, with people like Thomas Hobbes and John Locke being the progenitors of all that is good and true and valuable in the modern liberal tradition. And it is both heartening and sobering to reflect on the fact that you find the arguments made by Locke coming first not in Locke's work in 1689, but in Mencius's work in the year minus 300 and something. So you have here a different tradition, a Chinese tradition of thought, disconnected from the Western tradition, not beholden in any way to it, but yet containing the same fundamental idea that power derives ultimately from the people, not quite Locke's social contract, but nonetheless the basic idea that government exists to serve us, not we to serve it. It is, to me, fundamental that if we are to have any conception of what is the best way to live, that conception should be shared among us all. And the theory should be one that is accessible to all of us. Lockean theory is. Mencian theory is. Anybody can understand it without any real effort. So, when we are persuaded that we are free because we govern ourselves, which is the essential idea undergirding both Locke and Mencius, then we are going to see our rulers as our servants, and the decisions made by our rulers as being done in our service. Now, we may not agree with a lot of those decisions. We may think our rulers too harsh, or we may think them too mild. But we will go along with them as long as we believe our rulers are operating in our interests. It is when they cease operating in our interests that we will have trouble with them. Locke we will get to eventually, but Locke saw us as only getting upset with our rulers in extremis, in the case that our rulers and our concerns diverged extremely. Now that may or may not be the case. Mencius saw us as diverging from our rulers in a most extreme case, and that would require our ruler to be radically departed from our everyday needs and from our normal religious concerns. And that would be a vital difference between ruler and ruled. Bearing in mind that he wasn't expecting the ruler to consult the ruled, he was, however, expecting the ruler to consult the concerns of the ruled. And he was expecting the ruler, thus, to rule with moderation and care. Confucians, for example, are opposed to high taxes on the grounds that those taxes were eaten out of the working people, the poor, not out of the well-to-do who could transfer their tax burden onto the poor. And taxes in ancient China were in kind, which doesn't sound so bad until you realize that in kind, that tax in kind meant that there was less food for you over the winter, because food was taken in tax to pay the rulers, soldiers, and bureaucrats. And that meant less millet for the village, less cotton for the village, less rice for the village when they started growing rice. These are realities of life. And while we can't do without taxes, somebody has to provide for our security, after all, and that's the ruler's job. That's the job he or she has taken up. Somebody's got to maintain the roads. Somebody's got to do all the other things we want our rulers to do, that we demand that they do. And the more we demand, the more they have to pay for them, the more we have to pay for them, which is part of the cost of having a government. But Mencius wants us to have it as cheap as we can. Confucius wants us to have it as cheap as we can. So both of them want a fairly minimal government, not a very large government. Mencius, being more liberal than Confucius, would probably want government to do more for us, and would certainly be more liberal if he were around today. But that's all I can say about him and our current order. We have a huge gap of time between us and the philosophers of the past. And we can't say with any certainty what they would make of the world we live in. I know that all of them would be shocked by it, simply because they would not be able to comprehend easily the speed at which we live and the complexity of our societies would simply astound them. We would all seem quite mad to them. But we would all have the same problems. How do we live together? How do we order our lives together? And how do we maintain stability in our order? And we're still asking the same questions. And we're still trying to come up with the same kind of answers as people like Confucius and Mencius were millennia ago. and the answers are still the same, at least in principle. For Mencius, we had to seek a better moral understanding in ourselves. We had to realize that we were morally capable and that the better situated should set the example for the less well situated, the educated for the less well educated. Where Mencius differed from Confucius is that he believed, first of all, that all people are capable of being educated, all men at the very least. Mencius was a person who believed that every human being was capable of receiving an education in custom and logic and philosophy so that they could become a ruler, an advisor to rulers, a governor, a teacher, could hold public office. And this is what we might call the second fold of the Mencian vision. Because if anybody can be educated, to put it in terms of a more modern progressive, C.L.R. James, poor man, any cook can govern. And that is something that I believe very strongly, that we are all able to participate in our own government. And that is the democratic principle, the principle of equal ability to share in government. And Mencius gives us that. He gives us that in spades and in buckets and in huge, huge gallons. And we generally see Aristotle as the founding philosopher of democracy, at least of democracy as we have it today, though Aristotle would not have seen himself as a democratic thinker, and I'll explain why in the near future. But Mencius is arguably the first true democrat, inasmuch as he is the first thinker to make the argument that real power flows from the people, and that power belongs ultimately to the people and to no one else. And that is a principle that we are going to have to hold on to as tightly as possible in the coming days. Thank you for listening. Bye.